The following presentation was recorded at a Christian Light Education workshop. More information at clp.org.
Good morning and God bless you. It's a lovely morning and I'm glad that we can meet together as we are able to this morning. Whenever we consider a moral question of any sort, we always have to have something to go by. And of course, the only way we can go by, as has already been indicated this morning, is if there's an unchangeable to compare it to. Because, as we well know, we ourselves are changeable. We're a little bit relevant ourselves, aren't we? Or would you like to be 14 again? If that wouldn't satisfy you, maybe you'd like to go back to being 3. Would that be a switch? Think what it would be like to tomorrow be 3 instead of your age that you presently are. We are changing, and I'm glad the Bible talks to us about changing from glory to glory, and we want to change from glory to glory. We want to change for the right. But when we start making judgments, we have to have an unchangeable to make a judgment from. And so when we say, is there a moral, is this a moral issue? Is there a right and wrong? Is there an ethical issue here at stake? We encounter ethical questions all the time. People ask ethical questions. They say, well, what is appropriate things to do on the Lord's Day, or what is appropriate recreational or sports to be involved in? And they keep on asking lots and lots of questions. What are appropriate places to go on vacation? There is an unchangeable factor. There's an unchangeable place we can go to find answer to even such practical questions. And this is what helps make God's people restful, because we have a moral standard by which to go. Many years ago, I was teaching at Calvary Bible School, where I learned to know some of you that are here this morning. And one Friday morning, we had a pre-chapel experience. It was a prayer and fasting, non-breakfast experience. And the moderator got up and he asked the question, what's the greatest need in America today? And the students and pastors that sat there didn't say anything when he asked it the first time. When he asked it the second time, what's the greatest need in America today? The students still just sat there and didn't say anything. And this old preacher that the students lovingly called Moses, because he had a long beard and looked like a patriarch, and like he'd walked just right out of the Old Testament and come to Bible school, he rose to his feet and he answered the question, what is the greatest need in America today, with these words, the fear of God. And then he sat down. That is not what we discussed that day. What we discussed that day was the need for families and husbands and wives and sons and daughters to function together with the family. And that morning, we didn't just pray for those who are straying and having difficult times in our families, but we prayed for all the ones who are doing well in our families, and for the sons and daughters that are faithful and loyal. And folks, we shouldn't be forgetting them any day of our life. Our loyal students, we should be blessing God for them, and not just focus on those who do seem to give us a bit of trouble. But I just bless God for that experience that morning, though, because, well, it so happens that yours truly was the moderator, and he could not forget. He could not forget what that old man said, the fear of God. Some years later, we had gone to a prison service when we lived in Kelowna, Iowa, which is where I got to be Lucille's teacher. But anyway, and it was such a experience. One Sunday afternoon, we had a little lunch at church, and then the pastor preached up at this men's reformatory, and four of us men sang, and then we had about 25 minutes to spend with the inmates. And during that time of conversation, one of the men said to me, I liked your singing. And I said, well, that's interesting. By the way, I said, what do you think about rock music? And this inmate, who did not show any signs of being a Christian at all, said, I don't like rock. Well, he took me by surprise. I figured they all did. And then he said, secondly, but I don't condemn it either. And then he made this third comment, because I believe it has something to say. What does it have to say? So now I had two things to ponder. What does the sound of today's culture have to say? Now that's actually part of the first workshop. But sound speaks. Sound is a moral issue. And yet, people don't want sound to be a moral issue. Many people are debating it. And many people get quite emotional about it. And you can discuss all sorts of moral questions in our time, and you get along quite well. Once you start discussing music, then things begin to change. And people get upset, and people get emotional. And I think we have a very peaceful group here today, and I trust that will not be happening today. But you know, how can we keep, especially as teachers and leaders, how can we keep from being objective? And just opening our hearts and lifting up the shades, not just halfway, but the whole way. And just letting the Lord say, well, I'm not going to cover this part of my heart. I'm going to let you speak to me. Because you've got something really important to say to me. Is music indeed a moral issue? What is the fear of the Lord? What is fear? Well, there are places. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 8. Probably since we've been on the road a lot, a glass of water would be okay. This is like teaching regularly. If we go to Isaiah chapter 8, verse 11, we have this: For the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, Say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Here you have just a quick indication that you are not to be afraid. Now, there are many, many fears in the world, and admittedly, we have some fears too. And the whole animal kingdom has fears. That's okay, because if they didn't have fears, they would become the dinner of all the predators available around. So fear is not totally a bad thing, but a lot of fear is irrational. A lot of fear is based on falsehood. That's not good. Fears that are legitimate are based on truth and have two elements to them. Legitimate fears speak of a potency or power, and they secondly speak of eminence or presence. They have both power and they have presence. I was going to ask Steve this morning, didn't get him asked, just to see if you have copperheads in Ohio. We do in Pennsylvania. And they are a deadly snake. They are more deadly than rattlesnakes, I'm told. And I thought of what it would be like if I were to have brought a real, pretty gigantic copperhead in a pail, and I would take the lid off and I would dump it into the center aisle here at the workshop this morning. If I were to do so, you would lose your sense of propriety and also your quietness that you've been sitting here with, I'm sure. However, if my friend Mark over here would jump out and come to the center aisle and he would kill that, then suddenly you would crowd around to look at it and see what this snake had actually been. What's the difference between the two experiences? The first is snakes are potent, and a copperhead, thank you very much, and a copperhead is very potent. However, the bigger problem is not only that it's potent, but that it was present. It was here. And as soon as he eliminated the potency of it, the present didn't bother us. So you have to have two elements to make fear really work. And the other interesting thing is that I do see you sitting here quite relaxed this morning, but are you aware that there are many people who are killed every year by snake bites? And that there are snakes all over this world? How can you sit here so comfortably? Because their venom is powerful. It's potent. Oh, I know why. Because they're not present. See, what I'm saying is you have to have both of them together for it to cause them to be a legitimate fear. Now, there are many human fears that we go through, many human things that we experience. And I've experienced a few of those human things myself. Like being a foolish farm boy in Kansas who decides that after I throw out the silage out of the silo by hand, instead of going down over all that silage-laden rungs going down, I'm going to go up through the chute and come down the outside. And then that wasn't as bad as deciding once I got up there, I'm going to see how fast I can go down. And so when I was going down fast, suddenly I realized I was falling over backwards. I had neither hand on a rung. And I remember throwing my hands against those staves, and I found a rung. I panicked. I hadn't had an experience of panic like that for a long time. My brother, older brother, heard me say that one time. He said, "Do you know what happened next?" And I didn't even remember. He said, "You wouldn't come down." He said, "I had to crawl up the outside and pry your fingers loose to get you to come down." See, that's panic. And human fear, you know, can cause us to panic. And typically, when people, even people, especially of a certain gender, they can see a mouse and they're not silent when they panic. It just occurs. So usually there's noise that goes with panic. Now, there is something else, though. We have only read to a certain point here. Verse 12. I'd like for you to read one more verse with me. Verse 13. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. Why would God say such a thing? Why would we make God our fear object? Which doesn't sound nice, but for sake of interpretation, let's use it. Why would we make God our fear object? It's easy. God is not only present, he is everywhere present. You cannot go, you read the Psalms, you cannot go anywhere that is available for you to go to that God is not there. God is omnipresent, we say. How about powerful or potent? God is all powerful. And we call that omnipotent. So God has the two elements, the element of presence and the element of power, that is superior to anything that could ever happen to us. And both teachers and parents and pastors and board members take great comfort that they get to serve someone who is above all other fears. In fact, we take such great comfort in dark, dark times in this that we just slip right into the next verse and look at the next six or seven words. And this is what it says. When God becomes our fear, it says, and he shall be for a sanctuary. It's a place of restfulness. It's a place of quietness. It's a place where it does not matter what happens. I repeat. It does not matter what occurs in your life. Anything. As long as God is your presence and God is your personal power, you have a source that's greater than any circumstance that God's enemy could ever throw at you. And for us Christians this morning, for us who have responsibilities, that is a sanctuary we never want to leave. That is a place of rest we never want to leave. The word music. Where does it come from? The word music comes from the word muse. It's a root word. It's a word that's used in Scripture. And this word in Scripture, and just the word as you look it up and ponder it, simply means to think. That's what music does for us. It causes us to think. That gives us a clue what the nature of music is. The nature of music is devotional. In fact, we could say it is reverential. The nature of music is reverential. And I find it very extremely interesting that Peter Masters, a pastor who is pastoring Spurgeon's church, would write a book. And chapter 13, it's over on the table. Chapter 13, he spends the whole chapter on the point of reverence. And how reverence in the worship place is going to affect reverence in every other area of life. He says that reverence in the worship place is going to affect the reverence experience between husband and wife. Reverence in the worship place is going to affect the reverence experience in the workplace, where you work. Reverence is going to, in the corporate worship, is going to influence the reverence revealed in people's appearance. And it makes all kinds of statements that you wouldn't think would come out of London, would you? London, England. But it's a tremendous blessing to see people see that. And I was so blessed with the devotional this morning because it was made very plain that there is order, and our God is a God of order. And those numbers were just fantastic that we were looking at. And this is the point of music. Music should cause us to be devotional and to ponder and to think. But how many people are thinking these days? There are some other things you can do with the word, well, with any word, many words, with root words. You can begin adding prefixes and suffixes to them, as you're used to doing as teachers. For example, let's say I use the word poly, and I put it in front of theist. Theist is the idea of someone who believes in God. And so if you have a polytheist, you have a person who believes in many gods, like the Hindus, who would maybe believe in 1,000 gods, or other religions that have numerous gods. If you have a monotheist, then mono, you know, means one, just like dia means two. So when you have a dialogue, you have a conversation between two people. When you have a monologue, you're talking to yourself and hoping nobody hears you. And then, when you have a monotheist, you have a person who believes in one god. Okay, let's suppose that we use this, let's use this prefix here, and suddenly we change the meaning of that word greatly. Because as soon as we put that ah in front of it, and we pronounce it atheist, we have a person who now does not believe in God. And so we're going to take this same prefix and put it up here, and put a suffix after it, and we have amusement, and we have the implication here of not to think. And that's the purpose of amusement, is to cause people not to think. Why? Because life's tiring, and life has a lot of responsibilities and a lot of things to go through, and so we need amusement, we say. Well, the amusement has escalated in our country and in Europe and probably across the world by leaps and bounds. Technology has increased amusement to no end. So what do we have? A very restful culture today? Do we or don't we? Has amusement solved our problems? No, it hasn't, as you well know. But if you start discussing amusement with people, they're not too interested in discussing it because they do not want to cease to be amused. They don't want to stop thinking. One profound writer lamented the fact that we are living in a time when there are few thinkers. I had a teacher come to me yesterday and said he laments the fact that people do not want to think logically anymore. And if you can help your students to learn to think logically, you've given them a gift beyond just facts. When you can help them to think logically to good conclusions. So since objectivity is lost here, I think it's fair to just call this, that this is basically selfish in nature, because this is an untouchable. And objectivity has been lost. So this is an untouchable, and we know for ourselves that we are very interested in something that is devotional in nature, and that shows what we are really, how we really are, want to be like God in morality. Now, Vance Havner years ago made this statement that the word Christian is a noun, and as you know all too well, a name of a person, place, thing, or idea. And then he added the comment that it is also an adjective. And once again, we use the word Christian. What did he mean by that? It's an adjective. An adjective describes things, among other things, and one of the things that we describe in this case is we're sitting in a Christian church. This is not a Hindu meeting place, this is a Christian church. And you are teachers in a Christian school, and tonight you will sleep in a Christian home. Okay? So that describes the kind of Christian. He said the problem we're having today is that we do not have Christians around anymore. What did he mean by that? What he was actually implicating is that it's very important what happens in a person's heart. And people say it's only what's in the heart that matters. They are not so concerned what happens outside of a person's heart. But they say choices, everything boils down to what's in the heart. Well, that may be true, but if what's in the heart stays in the heart and does not reveal itself, of what value is what's in the heart? Of what practical value is what's inside? It's like the boy who went to Canada to help in a logging crew, a secular logging crew, came from a Christian home. And he was up there for 2 years, and his family, of course, was very worried about him. No cell phone service, no towers up there. It's long before this. When he came back, one of their early questions, of course, was, how did you make out as a Christian among all these non-Christian people? And the boy told them rather excitedly, he said, it was not a problem at all. They never found out I was one. I heard John Macagina in person make this statement. And he said, form and content must be in harmony. Form and content must be in harmony. What does he mean by that? I think what he meant by that is that content takes place here. Content is inside our heart. And it's tragic when people try to live life without having a heart change. Form is the expression of that outside. Form, and we express it in numerous different ways. Now the question is this morning, is form a moral issue? Or is just content a moral issue? Are we going to be judged at the end of time by content or by form? Or by the combination? Knowing that will help us make some decisions. Now, we could turn, and I don't think I'll take time to this morning, but we could turn to Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 4, and I'll read it for you. You don't have to turn to it. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4, and this is what it says. He is the rock, speaking of God. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment, a God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. Now there are seven things that it says about the character of God in that verse, in Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. And of course, when you say he is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are what? They are judgment. So you can begin to ask questions like, so is it true that we go to the character of God to make judgments and find answers on any moral questions? And yet you can say at the same time, but I don't know, nobody's ever seen God. This audience here has no problem understanding that God's character is the perfect standard for our lives. However, since we haven't seen God, how does God express himself? We learn to know God through his expressions. And his expressions are what? Oh, there are many. And in fact, in Zephaniah 3:17, I'm going to read you that verse. The Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. There's a scripture that says God sings. So if God is a singer, what kind of music do you think God sings? Well, just like the qualities that you saw in chapter 32. He is the rock. He sings, or would you say rock music? Well, the rock's capitalized in my Bible. And it speaks of stability and unchangeableness. And his work is perfect. God's song is perfect. He's a God of judgment. You don't ever have to say that, God, you made a wrong choice on that one. You can never say that about God. He's a God of truth. Truth, folks, truth is the most beautiful thing that exists today. Truth. It's powerful. And God's a God of truth, so what he sings is always true. You can't say that about everybody else. And it's without iniquity. There's no sin there. And he's just. God is just. You ever hear students say it's not fair? And the implication is that you weren't fair? I don't let my students say that. Although I have an agreement with them at the beginning of the school year that if they find me doing something wrong, they can come and tell me privately, and I will accept it. They have full liberty to do that because I tell them I am like they are. I'm also human, and I will make mistakes. And I don't mind you talking to me about it because I want to grow too. And it helps build respect. And then, of course, he says he's right. So God's song is right. Well, how does God express himself? Well, there are many ways that he expresses himself. But the first revelation is the revelation called the general revelation through nature. And there are beautiful scriptures that speak of this, like Psalm 19, where it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament showeth his handiwork, day unto day out of speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. For there is no speech nor language where the voice is not heard." When we say a general revelation, we mean a revelation that reaches every jungle camp there is. Every place in the entire globe has been reached by the area of nature. And it's a powerful thing because, I mean, God shows himself in so many powerful ways, including, well, I think there was an allusion this morning already to the idea that about the skies and what we see in the skies. That I found interesting because I remember my students' reaction when we were discussing how the Earth does the twirling in a 24-hour period, and then we know that as the rotation, and then it makes that revolution around the Sun in a 365 and a quarter day period, which we know marks our years. But what they couldn't quite understand is that the world, the Sun is moving through space at the rate of 150 miles per second. And if the Sun is moving through our galaxy in somewhat elliptical motion, at 150 miles per second, I mean, we've traveled 9,000 miles just since I started talking about it. And we're going back. We'd have to keep up with the Sun, or we'd be fried bacon or something, or worse. So obviously, our motion is not just circular and revolving, but our motion is also through our galaxy along with the Sun. And my son, when he was in eighth grade, he tried to figure out how far we've actually gone in 6,000 miles. And he used a calculator as long as he could. From then on, he used the pencil. And he came up with 28 trillion miles that we have traveled through the Milky Way galaxy. So as I'm sharing that with the students are saying, one girl raised her hand, she wanted to know, well, what's going to happen if we run out of our galaxy? And I said, well, my understanding is that we're about two-thirds of the way through at this point. And so it's not a practical question, because if it took 6,000 years to get this far, I don't think you and I will be here to go the rest of the way. I hope not. But I said, you know, if it were a problem, I think this is what would happen. I think that either Jesus would come back first, or since there are so many galaxies out there, God would just slide another galaxy right alongside the Milky Way, and we'd slip right into that one and keep going. God can do all sorts of things. He's a God of might. He's a God that's so great. So it tells us that he's a God of design. He's a God of order. And just as the brother was sharing with the different things that are keeping us here, I know that the German, no, it wasn't the German, it was the Russian man who had gone into space and said, he was out in space, he looked all around, he didn't see God anywhere. He should have thanked the Lord for the thermodynamics that took him up there and back. You know, what kept him going up there? I don't know of a culture that doesn't know what an egg is, even if they've never seen domesticated chickens. Everybody knows what an egg is. And there's something to learn about God in this little egg. It's just an illustration of nature. If you take this egg, you notice this end is kind of rounded, this end is slightly more pointed, and you would hatch this egg, which end would the chick come out? The top. Why? There's a reason why. Because the shell up here is only one half as thick as it is down here. Now, before I tell you what happens, let me also demonstrate the strength of this egg. You can take that egg, push end to end on that egg, and you can push hard. And if you don't think you can push hard enough, I know you're hoping it'll break, but it won't. And I can take both hands, and I can squeeze on that egg, and I'm pushing hard now, and it is not breaking. And it will not break. Why? That tells us that God is a God of design. He's a God of order. He's a God of design. And also the fact that the chick hatches out of the top. I mean, one man put this in a centrifugal machine and spun it 10,000 times, and the poor dizzy chick still hatched out of the top. Why? There's a two-day supply of air up here. And God has arranged that that chick needs a two-day supply of air, and also that this shell is only one half as thick up here, which tells us that God is a God of efficiency. And he doesn't want that chick to work twice as hard as it ought to get out there. And he doesn't want Mennonites to do it either, work twice as hard as it should. I'm told that when this egg is laid, that usually it lands on this part here. Why? Because it's twice as thick. And God loves life. We know that about the character of God. And so there's, you know, 200% less chance for this egg to break if it lands on that, on this end right here. And of course, when this chick does hatch, then what happens? You have the most beautiful, lovely, beautiful little chick that comes out. The two-year-old almost squeezes it to death. And I always like to have them in the house for at least 48 hours because I just like to hear the music. I mean, God is a God of order. God is a God of efficiency. God is a God of design. God is a God who loves life. God is a God of beauty. And God is a God of sounds. And we have all that, and these eggs are laid in our country alone. There's 2,000 of these testimonies laid every second in this country. So, would God like for us to learn? Now, here's a sobering thing, and there are many, many more illustrations, but time is going faster than I. There are two more revelations, and the next one is a specific revelation. You have this laying on your lap. It's the Bible. What do you read when you read the Bible? Is he a God of order? Is he a God of beauty? Is he a God of design? Is he a God who loves life? Is he a God of efficiency? Do you see Jesus rushing around? Do you see him cramming for things like we do? Preparing for class or for tests or making quizzes or whatever? No. And not only do we have this specific revelation, and the specific revelation goes with the general revelation and shows us the same expression of God's character and what God's character is like, but we also have a personal revelation. It's like God wants to make absolutely sure that you and I know what he's like. And Jesus is the personal revelation. When he sent him to earth, you can read Matthew, you can read Mark, you can read Luke, you can read John. And folks, you will see, and Jesus himself said, if you see me, you've seen the Father. That's what Jesus says. So, we have at least a momentary clue what God's character is like. Now, how do we know human character? Well, we also never see each other's heart. So I can't say, I see your heart. How do we get to know each other? We get to know each other then by our expressions. What are our expressions? Talking. Talk is a very common expression. And what a day this would be if nobody would talk. We meet all day long and nobody says a word the whole day, and then we all go home tonight. What would we have learned? Talking is an expression. Does the Bible consider talking a moral issue? And I know we're using the principle of association this morning to make the point. There's a lot of other ways to make the point about moral issues, but we're using the principle of association. Okay, brother, I'm going to be done before long here. I'll work on it. Okay, the average American man speaks 12,000 words a day. Now, Matthew 12, 35 or 36 says that every idle word that a man shall speak, he must give account of. What do you think of that? That's 12,000 opportunities per day for something that we're going to be judged by. The average American woman speaks somewhere between 28,000 to 40,000 words per day. One lady explained to me why that happened. She said the men are saying, huh, all the time. And I thought, she's right. If we would listen better, the women wouldn't have to talk near as much. But the sobering part is the very next verse. The very next verse says that by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Our eternal destiny is at stake by this human expression. It's a moral issue. And so we go to the next one, writing. And people say, writing? Oh, students come in from recess. They say, somebody said a bad word. And I say, what did they say? And so they don't say. They take a note card or something, they write it down and hand it to me. So if you write it down, it's not a moral issue. Come on, folks, we're older than that. We know that writing is just as mature. They both show the belief and value system, worship. Worship is a human expression, folks. And God knows it's a human expression of the belief and value system in our heart. It's an important one. And I know there's superficial differences this morning. But folks, there are ways of worshiping that absolutely do not balance the character of God. And that's why I believe in 1 Corinthians 14, the last verse, it said, let everything be done decently in an order. That's in the context of worship. And Peter Masters has a good chapter on that as well. And then there's the issue of appearance. And today people are saying that appearance is totally value neutral. This is far more true in the Christian world, perhaps, than even the other world. The Christian world is saying it is value neutral. Clothes don't mean anything. Appearance doesn't mean anything. Symbolism that comes with the clothes and all the accessories, they don't mean anything. Now, come on, folks. We need to wake up. Of course. People's appearance reveal what's inside. It's their character. And people's appearance can give a tremendous, be a tremendous blessing, and the Bible addresses it by modesty. There's different ways to be modest. I grant that. But it still calls for modesty. And furthermore, clothes can do, and the tattoos and everything else can do the exact opposite. They can swear. They are like billboards that telegraph the belief and value system we have inside. And so it's not something, it's something that obviously we will be judged by. Then there's the issue of actions. And of course, actions, the Bible is very clear that by our works we're going to be judged. It's not a question to us. We say, oh, I'm a Christian, but I'm going to have some vodka today. No, you're not going to do that because the Bible's too clear on that. So you're not going to do that. So as we see that talking is a human expression that reveals our character, so is writing, worship, appearance, actions. Music is a human expression. It's a beautiful one, but it shows the belief and value system that we embrace and that we employ. That is why it becomes so important. Since this is what we're going to be judged by, that the content influences the form, and we truly become Christians. God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.